From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. New Yorker reporter Lawrence Wright's new history of the Church of Scientology is called Going Clear. You can't buy it in Canada or the United Kingdom. Lawrence Wright is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Looming Tower. He makes his home in Austin, Texas, but he's talking to us today from Berkeley, California, where he is working on a play. Lawrence Wright, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, Ross. It's good to be with you.
What's the play?
It's called Fallaci, and it's about Arianna Fallaci, who was a titanic figure in journalism when I was a young man. She was probably the most famous journalist of her era. And, you know, she was a tiny Italian woman who, before the women's rights movement, just became this big international journalist who would bring world leaders to their knees. And then she went into a period of obscurity. And then after 9/11, she wrote these anti-Muslim screeds that were extremely influential, especially in Europe.
And Arianna Fallaci, one of the most renowned interviewers going, too. She was famous for that.
She was amazing. And what many people may remember about her is she was the first Westerner to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And in the course of the interview, she ripped off her hijab saying she was going to take off this stupid medieval rag and causing the Ayatollah to jump up and run out of the room. And she had determined that because she thought that he hated women so much that she would speak to him only in the voice of the one woman that he truly respected and feared, which was that of his mother.
Wow.
So when he ran out of the room, she said, "Where do you go to make pee-pee?" And then she wouldn't leave until he agreed to talk to her again. And he did.
Play,
a woman like that is just, you know, you rarely run into anybody with that kind of nerve.
That play writes itself, Lawrence, right? I mean, do you have to dramatize it at all?
Well, it's challenging because I was originally asked to write a one-woman show, but I just felt that her views are so controversial that they had to be challenged. And so I created another character who is actually an Iranian-American obituary writer for The New York Times who is going to meet with Arianna before and after 9/11 to interview her for her obituary.
Lawrence Wright is my guest. His new book is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. You know, every 10 pages in this book about L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology, my jaw dropped at some new thing that you brought out in it. You prepared extensively for this book. You learned all that you could. When you were doing your reporting, were there things that made your jaw drop?
Oh, my God. I couldn't believe, first of all, how lucky I was to have the opportunity to write about such amazing characters as I have in this book. And certainly Hubbard is a titan in that regard. Where shall I start? I mean, you know, just as a writer, take your hat off to him. He has the Guinness Book of World Records for the number of book titles published, more than 1,000. He used to write 100,000 words a month when he was working for the pulps in the 40s and 30s. And he would roll a butcher paper into his typewriter carriage and just, you know, speed type. And then when he was done, he would tear it off with a T-square and send it off to the publisher. I guess the thing that I found most disturbing and unsettling in my research was the exploitation of children inside the clergy, which is called the Sea Org or Sea Organization. And I still find that very upsetting.
The power of Scientology is kind of wrapped up in the personal story of the founder, L. Ron Hubbard, and specifically his story that he used Dianetics, his techniques, to cure himself from crippling injuries that he suffered during World War II. That's kind of a central part of Scientology. What does he say that he was able to do, and what were we able to find out about what happened?
After the war, after World War II, he was in the Oakland Military Hospital, and he said that he was blinded and crippled and that medicine couldn't help him, and he had to heal himself using techniques that he later developed into Dianetics, which became the basis of Scientology. And yet when we got hold of his military records, they showed that he had never been injured in the war, and his medical records show that he had conjunctivitis and ulcers, but he was scarcely crippled and blinded. So this seems to be a legend that he invented about himself.
This is a huge issue, too, within the Church of Scientology. At the end of Going Clear, you and the New Yorker executives and the Scientology officials and their and the respective lawyers of you both kind of come around to this issue of Hubbard's curing himself, and you find out that this is really a core belief of the entire religion.
Oh yeah, we were the episode you referenced was one of the most amazing days of my reporting career. I had been trying to get the spokesperson of Scientology at the time. His name was Tommy Davis. He had agreed when I started my project, he was going to take me through Scientology. We're going to see, you know, the church from the inside, and he wanted me to allow enough time. So I went out over Memorial Day in 2010. And sat in the hotel cooling my heels for two nights and 2 days, and finally he arrived to tell me that he was not going to take me through Scientology. He wasn't going to talk to me at all. And, you know, it was pretty clear that he'd been told not to. But I got him to agree to respond to fact-checking queries, and I'm not sure that he really understood what he was in for, where, you know, fact-checking at the New Yorker is a very serious enterprise. And the first volley of fact-checking queries that we sent off to him were 971 questions. More than 1,000 eventually were sent in his direction. But in September of that year, he and his wife and assistant, Jessica Feshbach, along with four Scientology lawyers, arrived at the New Yorker offices carrying 47 white binders of material to respond to our 971 queries. And it was the one time I had the opportunity to actually interview Tommy in the midst of this rather large conference room meeting with the Scientology delegation, with David Remnick, the editor of the New Yorker, and my editor, and the two fact checkers and the head of the checking department and our lawyer, all these people sitting around essentially there to watch me and Tommy have a conversation. And it was, I knew, my only opportunity to do this. In the process of that conversation, we started talking about Hubbard's war record, and Tommy said, if it's true that the founder of Dianetics was not a war hero and was never injured in the war and never healed himself using those Dianetic techniques, then Dianetics is a lie and Scientology is based on a lie. The truth of the matter is that L. Ron Hubbard was a war hero. Well, when he said that, I'm sure that everybody on the New Yorker side of the table, you know, we all raised our eyebrows, because that's a testable hypothesis. We already had a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information request, to the military archives in St. Louis for Hubbard's medical records, but we sent an intern to St. Louis to speed things along, and we've got 900 pages of what was his complete military files, and there's absolutely nothing in there about his injuries, nothing that demonstrates he served heroically during the war. In fact, rather the opposite. I mean, the main incidents in his career that are really notable are that he was commanding a subchaser, a small ship on the Pacific coast, and right outside of port, he thought that he'd run into a Japanese submarine and spent a night and a day dropping depth charges on what turned out to be a log. And then he took a little gunnery practice on Mexico. And so, you know, his commanders took a dim view of him assaulting an ally. So he had, you know, an undistinguished war record, and other private journals, he admits that. But for the point of view of creation of Dianetics and Scientology, he was a great war hero.
Well, he was factually a prodigious writer, as you say, and certainly had a great deal of personal charisma about him. And yet you point out all these zany things that he did. You describe a book that L. Ron Hubbard wrote back in 1957 called All About Radiation, and in it he promotes a cure for cancer and sunburns. It's made of nicotinic acid and vitamins, and he recommended the formula be taken with milk and chocolate. That was one of the jaw-dropping moments for me, that he could put this forward and still be treated seriously. It sounds like something like that would ruin the career of a lesser person.
You know, so many times you wonder if he's just got his tongue in his cheek. But, you know, he would do things that, you know, like, you know, he created, you know, he employed this thing called the E-meter. And it is essentially, when it first started, it was two Campbell soup cans with the labels scraped off of them. And they were connected to a meter through, you know, with some electrical wires and a small amount of current passing through. And the idea was that you could, in Hubbard's theory, was that the E-meter could actually measure the mass of your thoughts. And there's no evidence that your thoughts have mass, but that was a whole theory that you could probe with this instrument. And while he was in England, he actually started applying the E-meter to tomatoes to demonstrate that plants feel pain. And he allowed himself to be photographed, studying these tomatoes that are wired up to his meter.
Lawrence Wright is my guest. The book is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. You mentioned the disturbing revelations that you found about the way that children were treated in Scientology. And the book is replete with examples of people who have in some way gone astray from the rules of Scientology and end up getting locked in basements and fed table scraps and wore rags and worked for no money for an enormous amount of time. And I read those accounts going, why did people stay there? And it kind of brings to mind that what they must have, they still seemed in many ways to be true believers despite the way that they were treated by their own religion.
You know, one of the subtitles of the book is The Prison of Belief. And the reason that's in there is I too was very puzzled by the fact that people endured this kind of indignity, and many of them had to escape in order to leave. I've talked to so many people that fled the church and oftentimes were brought back even physically and confined involuntarily for long periods of time. But it's also the case that people stayed in the church because they thought that they were healing the planet and saving mankind. There's a compound in Southern California, 500-acre compound, that is the international headquarters of the Sea Org, their clergy. And there are a couple of double-wide trailers that have been married together and were a kind of office suite. And in 2006, the leader of the church, David Miscavige, began confining his executives there. Some of them have been there for 7 years. And one night he came in with a jam box and said they were going to play musical chairs. Now, bear in mind, these people have been sleeping on the floor. They, living there, with only a brief period of time outside each day to take a shower and then back in there day and night. And many of them report being beaten or beating each other, and there's horrible, horrible conditions. But this game of musical chairs, according to the sources I talked to, Miscavige had said that, only the last person standing or sitting, the last person in the chair would be allowed to stay. Everybody else was going to be either kicked out of the Sea Org or sent off to some remote location. They actually had airline tickets printed up to add reality to this. And this thing went on till like 2 in the morning, people fighting, chairs broken, clothes torn. And what was so striking to me is they were fighting to remain there. That to me really exemplified the kind of mental confinement that so many people inside Scientology endure.
It's easy to read about these examples and want to sling the word cult at Scientology, but you're also at pains to point out that some of this extreme behavior not unknown in more established religions.
Sure. I mean, when it gets down to trying to distinguish between a religion and a cult, it becomes very difficult. And, you know, in courtrooms, when you are using terms like that lightly, there are plenty of experts that the church can hire to demonstrate that in, you know, Catholicism, for instance, you know, friars flay themselves on Friday. You know, they live in very, very Spartan quarters. They have nothing. They have no material goods and so on. They, you know, the only agency entitled with the, or empowered with the right to make the distinction between what is a cult and what is a religion is the IRS. And you and I can have different opinions about it, but it's the IRS, which is very poorly equipped to make such distinctions, that has the authority. And in 1993, in the face of 2,300 lawsuits that the church launched against the IRS and individual agents and private investigators who were made to follow, hired to follow individual agents and determine who was drinking too much and who was having, you know, fooling around on the road and that kind of thing. Under all that kind of pressure, the IRS, whatever the argument to be made for or against church as a religion, they decided that Scientology was a religious community, and as a part of the bargain, those lawsuits were dropped, and the private investigators were called off the trail.
The Church of Scientology is not at all shy about fighting really hard when it's being criticized by journalists, as you recount how the careers of journalists and others who've reported critically have been crippled by lawsuit after lawsuit. They've just been beaten down. I note that your book is Going Clear is not being sold now in Canada and the United Kingdom. Are there any other signs of Scientology retaliating against you for publishing this book?
Well, they have not, you know, I've not been harassed. They did threaten my British publisher, and in the libel laws in Britain are such that the publisher decided not to publish. I regret that, but I was in England 2 weeks ago talking to members of Parliament about a new law that they're considering that would allow public interest journalism such as my book to be published. England has an unhappy record of being a kind of venue for libel suits from people all over the world. And I have great hopes that that book will eventually be published in England because of it.
That's interesting that they haven't retaliated against you in the way they have against other critical journalists. Does that say something about where the Church of Scientology is now, that they're not launching a full court press against you with civil suits and things they've done to critics in the past?
Well, they may yet do that. I mean, who knows? But, you know, I was very careful in the book. You know, I hired, you know, not just during the New Yorker period of the investigation. After that, when I started working on the book, I hired fact checkers to make sure that I got the facts straight. I repeatedly queried the church about items that were in the book for their response, and they were laggardly and hostile in their responses. They demanded a week, 7 days, to respond to each question. And, I mean, that entirely unreasonable. You know, I had 150, 100 something, 60 questions for them, and it would have taken more than 3 years for them to respond to those questions. But in any case, I gave them the chance to get their perspective on the record. And I repeatedly asked for the opportunity to talk to higher-level executives and to the leader of the church, David Miscavige, but they denied me that opportunity.
We've just barely scratched the surface. We haven't even talked about how the Church of Scientology has cultivated people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta, about how they won one of their biggest victories right here in the Pacific Northwest back in 1985. And we haven't even talked about their huge program of domestic espionage called Operation Snow White. It's an amazing work. It's called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Lawrence Wright, thanks for talking to us about it. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Ross.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Amber Cortez, and Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.